You're traveling through another dimension. A dimension not only of sight and sound, but of mind. A journey into a wondrous land whose boundaries are that of imagination. Your next stop, the Twilight Zone.
Welcome, everyone, to Breaking Kayfabe. I'm your host, Jeff Bowdrin. And on this show, we are not just going to break kayfabe on the wrestling business. We will break kayfabe on sports, movies, television, music, pop culture. We're going to break kayfabe on life. And on today's show, we're going to discuss a special edition of Breaking Kayfabe. We are honored to be joined by Mark Zickrey. Mark wrote a book called The Twilight Zone Companions. Folks, it is your moment in time. We are doing a Twilight Zone episode. Woohoo! And with us to discuss that is not only Mark, but my good friend, Mr. Co-host to you, Barry Rose. Barry, what's going on?
No, so this is almost like a dream come true for me. You and I have been friends for so many years, so you know the importance of the Twilight Zone in my life and how I still watch episodes every single week. And being able to have Mark here, who is, I guess I was going to say, arguably the most thorough Twilight Zone expert that there is, but I don't think you can actually argue that, can you, Jeff?
Well, I don't know. Mark, did you actually take a college course in the Twilight Zone? Because I know my man, Mr. Rose, did here. I don't know if it was an elective class or like you got a math or science credit for it or something, Barry. But Mark, we are certainly happy to have you join us here on this special edition of Breaking Kayfabe. First of all, Mark, tell us how you first got interested in the show, and then give us we want to hear a little background on the man that created it all, Rod Sterling. So why don't you tell us how you first became interested in the show?
Sure, yeah. Well, I grew up watching Twilight Zone as a kid, and it was on in syndication, so it was on every day, every weekday when I was a kid on KPLA in the afternoons, and I thought it was just a terrific show. There was nothing like it. It was amazing. And the more I delved into it, the more I was impressed and the more I wanted to learn about it. And at that point, there was nothing written about it. There were no books on the Twilight Zone. You couldn't read how that show had gotten made. So as soon as I got out of college, I knew I wanted to be a writer, producer in TV. And I just thought writing a book on the Twilight Zone would not only be a great way to find out about this amazing show, but also to learn how to write and produce television myself. So it was 2 years after Rod Serling's death, and he died very prematurely at age 50 of complications from open heart surgery. But his widow, Carol, gave me full access to everything, his files, his scrapbooks, his own 16mm prints of the Twilight Zone, everything. I was crawling through his attic, and it was an amazing experience. So in terms of Rod Sterling and his background, Rod grew up in upstate New York in Binghamton. He joined the paratroops in World War II right out of high school, and he decided after the war that he wanted to be a writer, and so he just started writing enormous numbers of scripts and getting huge amounts of rejections. He joked that he would wallpaper his bathroom with his rejection slips. And but fortunately, he started selling to radio shows, and then TV was just starting up. It was the late 40s, early 50s, and he started selling to TV shows. There were a lot of anthology shows, live TV, and he quickly rose to where he was the top writer working in TV. He was writing for a show called Playhouse 90. He was very prestigious. He was winning Emmys, and he was the most successful writer in TV. And so Rod was writing things like Playhouse 9 for like Requiem for Heavyweight, etc., these mainstream dramas. Rod never wanted to be a science fiction writer at all. He wanted to be a mainstream writer, the Arthur Miller of television. And but he was censored. It was the 1950s. And so anytime he wanted to write about politics or social issues or race, he couldn't get it past the censors. So at one point, he was so frustrated when he wrote something about Congress where he couldn't even use the terms Republican or Democrat that he said, look, if I said this thing in the 21st century and people to Congress were robots, I could have gotten my point across. And that was the germ of the idea for Twilight Zone. So he wrote four pilot scripts for the Twilight Zone before he finally sold the show. And it sold, and it ran for five seasons. And he wrote 92 out of 156 episodes himself. He was the producer of the show. The buck stopped with him. He was the host, the visioner of the show, and it's lived all these decades because of what he did right back then.
Now, wow. I believe the pilot episode was an episode called "Where Is Everyone," or "Where Is Everybody" with Earl Holland. Yeah. Is that correct?
That's correct. Yeah, and interestingly enough, if you look at that episode, it's one of the few that could actually take place in objective reality, because it's about a guy who's he's alone in a town. There are no other people. He has amnesia. And then I won't spoil the ending, but let's say that he comes to realize who he really is. And it's a story that could have taken place in reality. There really isn't a fantasy element other than it being odd. And the reason Rod wrote that one was so he could get it past the CBS executives and past the sponsors, and they would think it was a much more down-to-earth show than what he had in mind, and that got the show greenlit. This is 1959, after all, so Rod was really pushing the envelope to the extreme.
You know, one of the things, I'll get to you in a second, Barry. One of the things I really appreciate about the show is, you know, here's Earl Holliman. Earl Holliman had a very 20-year plus career in Hollywood as a veteran character actor. He's probably best known to people of my general age group as being the police sergeant or the police captain and policewoman with Angie Dickinson. But yeah, throughout the show's history, you just spot, you know, everyone from Jack Klugman, Burgess Meredith, Robert Redford, so many great character actors came out of this show.
You bet. Lee Marvin, on and on and on. It's a who's who. And because it happened, because Twilight Zone aired from 1959 to 1964, they were able to get all these young up-and-coming actors who would become movie stars, like Robert Redford, Lee Marvin, etc. And then also the older actors from the golden age of Hollywood, like Ida Lupino, people like that, Howard Duff, and get them as well. And so it was an amazing talent pool. And then the writers were phenomenal, Richard Matheson, Charles Beaumont, George Clayton Johnson. Earl Hamner went on to create the Waltons and Falcon Crest. So, and the composers, Bernard Herrmann, Jerry Goldsmith, I mean, these were the royalty of Hollywood. And so it all started with the writing, because the scripts were so amazing. Rod could get top talent because they wanted to be part of the Twilight Zone, and they wanted to be participating in shows that were meaningful.
Sure. So Barry, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, absolutely too. So so you just mentioned, Mark, in the beginning of what you were saying, is that, so your first memories were watching KTLA reruns. What year was that?
Yes. That was probably in the maybe early 60s, maybe 64, 65, 66, around then. You know, the three shows that made me want to be a writer were Twilight Zone, Outer Limits, the original version of that show, and Star Trek, the original Star Trek. And so I was really lucky to grow up in this golden age of television science fiction, because Rod, and it all started with Rod Serling, because Rod said that science fiction doesn't have to be children's fair. Prior to Rod, there were things like Space Patrol or Tom Corbett's Space Cadet. Science fiction would sort of look askant by the mainstream. And Rod said no, he was going to create something that would be as profound and as meaningful as any mainstream drama, and he pulled it off. Of course, he won the Emmy for best drama 2 years running for the first season and second season of Twilight Zone, so he proved his point.
Yeah, one of my first memories too, and I was mentioning this to Jeff. So, but I grew up in South Florida, in North Miami Beach, and we used to have a television station called Channel 51. And my personality now is probably a little bit offbeat, and I can trace it back to three distinct things. The first was my father taking me to see professional wrestling when I was 7 years old. The second being a viewing of Todd Browning's Freaks when I was 9 years old. And then I would stay up and I would watch The Twilight Zone at midnight, even as a young child, in reruns.
Wow.
And yeah, exactly. So it was really, what's your first memory of The Twilight Zone? If I had to see, I know what mine is. What would be yours?
My first memory of The Twilight Zone was when I was a kid. My stepfather was sort of a handyman, and he, in our garage, he had two TV sets up on a high shelf, and one only got picture and one only got sound, and he'd usually have them tuned to different channels from each other. So it'd be very weird getting the soundtrack from one station and that picture from another. And then one night I was up past my bedtime, and I looked up, and on the TV that only had got picture, there were these three astronauts landing in a flying saucer on an alien planet, and then going into another crashed spaceship and finding their own dead bodies. And that, I didn't know what that was. I had no idea. But it was an episode of The Twilight Zone called Death Ship, starring Ross Martin and Jack Klugman. It was an hour-long episode. This must have been 1963, because that was when the hour episodes initially aired. And it was many years later that I would find out that was a Twilight Zone episode and who those actors were. But it was a really formative experience. It was quite something to see that at the time, really, and shocking. It was an episode by Richard Matheson, and really scary.
Well, Jeff, do you remember your first Twilight Zone episode?
You know, I was just trying to think here. I think probably the first episode I saw, and it's one that we're going to discuss. Each of us, folks, what we've done is Barry and I have each come up with a top 10 list, and we are going to present Mark with our top 10 list and, you know, basically start a discussion on each particular episode, what Mark remembers, whether Mark thinks it's a good episode or bad, because I have to tell you, I know one of the ones that I've selected in my top 10 is one that Mark is not a big fan of. But that being said, the first one that I remember was, I believe in school, maybe in college, I was late to the game, I have to admit. One of my college professors showed The Occurrence at Owl Creek Bridge. And I was completely spellbound, and I was like, where did this come from? And, of course, that was a very special episode of The Twilight Zone, wasn't it, Mark?
Yeah, it was. It was very unusual because that was aired during the fifth and final season of Twilight Zone, and the show was running over budget, and William Krug, who was the producer, was looking for ways to get it back under budget, and he saw a French short film that was an adaptation of a story by Ambrose Bierce set during the American Civil War, and the few lines of dialogue that were in it were in English, and it has a very a surprising twist ending, and he realized that it would absolutely fit in as a Twilight Zone episode, so he bought the rights to air it twice, and they filmed a little introduction with Rod Serling standing by a camera, and it aired, and then subsequently it actually won the Oscar for Best Short Subject, so beyond Twilight Zone winning two Emmys for Best Series, an episode of Twilight Zone actually ended up winning an Oscar, So it was the only episode of Twilight Zone that was not made by the actual production team on Twilight Zone, but it fits right in, and it's a really, really nice piece of work.
Yeah, you know, one of the things I really appreciate and like about the show, especially when you consider the time that the show was produced and presented to the public, you know, Rod Serling presents themes of everything from paranoia to villainous people getting their comeuppance at the end. People, you know, deals with themes like loneliness, coming to grips with their own mortality, different sorts of themes like that. And that was pretty heavy stuff for the time, wasn't it?
It was. Yeah, it was. No, Rod was really trying to comment on real life. And that's why you can watch those episodes over and over and over again, even when you know what the twist ending is. Because it's not just about the snapper. It's about the real comment on life and death and love and all and alienation, all the things that we feel strongly in our lives. So it's a hugely meaningful show. And the fact that Rod was forced by the censors to write science fiction and fantasy and horror meant that it became more universal, it became more general. So he wasn't just writing about the events of the day. And so Twilight Zone is just current now, if not more so, than it was in the 50s and early 60s.
So absolutely. So as I said, Barry and I have each compiled a top 10 list. And trust me, speaking on behalf of Barry, that was not easy to do because there are literally so many great episodes. Coming up with a top 10 list is very hard.
Yeah.
So Barry, why don't you start us off? Give us your number 10 episode. We're going to have Mark discuss some memories of the show and the episode. And so fire away, Barry, what's number 10 on your list?
Yeah, absolutely. So, really, really hard too. So I had to, and I should just preface this, I had to come up with a top 25, and then I had to continue to whittle this down. For me, number 10 is going to be I Shot an Arrow into the Air. I am just so taken with this episode. And I got to say too, so your book means a lot to me on a personal level. I probably have read it 10 times and maybe even more. And occasionally I'll pick it up and I'll just go through it. I might look at a specific episode, but I went through your book about this and it was really interesting is that you tell the story, and I'm going to let you tell the story about how this episode actually came to be.
Rod actually wrote, as I mentioned, he wrote four pilots for Twilight Zone, and one was called I Shot an Arrow into the Air, and it was a completely different episode, a completely different storyline about an alien coming to Earth. And later he cannibalized the plot for an episode called The Gift. It was shot, and he took the title, I Shot an Arrow into the Air, because he thought it was a great title, and he used it for a completely different episode that was made when Twilight Zone got picked up. And it was basically, it was about a group of astronauts who were fired off into space and crash land on what they think is an asteroid. And ultimately we discover that they're not at all where they think they are. And it's a shocking episode. It's a lot of fun, very memorable. They did a number of episodes set on quote-unquote asteroids, because they would be these desert terrains. They would go to Mojave or Pine, you know, or or Death Valley, places like that. And so those were very within driving distance of LA or a short flight. And so, Twilight Zone could do those episodes with astronauts quite often. And of course, this was Twilight Zone was aired during the beginning of the space race. And so that was on very much on everyone's mind, with John Glenn and all of that. So it's a really fun episode and a really good cast.
A fantastic cast. And one of the stories I'd heard also was that Rod Serling was out somewhere at a social situation and was approached by a woman named Madeline Champion, who kind of pitched the idea to him.
That's right. And that happened to Rod often, but it's very rarely that someone would say, here's an idea for, usually when someone would say, here's an idea for Twilight Zone, Rod would just kind of wince because it would be terrible ideas. But in that case, It was a great idea, and so he bought it on the spot, and of course it was a terrific, memorable episode. Rod once said that often he would come up with stories where he had a beginning and a middle, and could not come up with an ending, and he wouldn't write those. But if he had the ending, he could get there. He could know how to get there. So anytime he had a really great ending, he knew where he was going. So that's what he loved. And so if someone came up with a snapper that was terrific, he would jump. He would really jump.
Yeah, so hey, I wanted to ask you a question too. It's something that you mentioned a couple of minutes ago when we were discussing, I guess, writers, and you mentioned the name Earl Hamner Jr. In reading your book, you actually acknowledged three people as far as the inspiration. One was George Clayton Johnson, the fantastic writer, Carol Serling, and your wife Elaine. Were George Clayton Johnson and Earl Hamner Jr., were they the last of the living Twilight Zone writers?
Yes. They of the major ones, yes. And, because they weren't the major writers of Twilight Zone were a very small number of people. It was Rod Serling, Richard Matheson, Charles Beaumont, George Clayton Johnson, and Earl Hamner. That's pretty much it in terms of writers writing multiple episodes and very memorable episodes. Every now and then you'd have someone writing maybe one episode, but these were the real core of writers. And other than Earl Hamner, Richard Matheson, George Clayton Johnson, and Charles Beaumont were all proteges of Ray Bradbury. So Ray Bradbury had a very, very strong influence on Twilight Zone.
Wow. So, and here's a trivia question, and my wife asked me this the other day. So is there only one person who ever wrote and directed an episode, being Montgomery Pittman?
Yes. There were others, like, for instance, Ida Lupino starred in one episode and directed a different one. And Douglas Hayes, my friend Doug Hayes, really great guy. He directed a lot of great episodes, at The After Hours, The Howling Man, Eye of the Beholder, many others. And he came close to writing and directing one because one time he said to Rob, listen, he was a writer as well, and he said, I've got a great idea for Twilight Zone. He said, I have an insurance salesman who can look at people and tell how and when they're going to die. And Rod said, that's a great idea. We'll drop the contract and we'll hire you to write it. And that was on a Friday. And Monday, Rod called Doug and said, listen, it was such a great idea, I couldn't help myself. I just sat down and wrote it. And what he wrote was a much better, he wrote a much better episode called The Perfect Testament, about soldiers in World War II, one of whom can see a glow on the faces of the soldiers who are about to die. It's a terrific episode. So Rod actually took that idea, which is a good idea, and made it even better. And Doug said, well, that's the way it goes, I guess. And he continued directing episodes of Twilight Zone, but he came close. But yeah, Monty Pittman was the one guy to write and direct Twilight Zone. And he was a wonderful writer and director. I mean, last director, Jeff Myrtlebank, many of the stuff he did too, which was with Charles Bronson, who was in Montgomery as an American soldier and a Russian soldier during World War III. He was really, right up there. He was terrifically talented.
Yeah, the Purple Testament too. Dick York, if I'm correct, from Bewitched, was the star of that, correct?
He was very memorable. I mean, again, you get these actors who you see in all the great TV shows of the 60s because they would all appear on all of the shows. So someone might be on a Twilight Zone one week and then a Gunsmoke the next, and then Bewitched or I Dream of Jeannie. You know, it was a great time for that sort of ensemble of really talented television actors.
Yeah, one of my favorite things to do also is every time I watch an episode is to start to go through IMDb and start to see what they had done previously. So on Friday night, I was with my wife and my kids, and I was like, you know what, we're going to watch this episode because I think it's so cool. And it was called The Fever, and it stars Everett Sloan. So I'm watching this, and I love it where it's the slot machine, and I love how it keeps going, Franklin. I just thought that was so cool. But then I Google Everett Sloan, and he was in Citizen Kane.
I know. Amazing, amazing. And yeah, he was one of the Mercury players and phenomenal actor. And he was actually in the first live TV broadcast that Rod wrote, that won him his first Emmy, a TV show called Patterns. And he starred in that, and then that was made into a movie. And he played the same role again as this hard-driving businessman. So when Twilight Zone came on, Evan Sloan was definitely one of the first actors that Rod approached.
Wow. So Jeff, I'm going to throw the ball in your court now. What is your number 10 episode?
Yeah, my number 10 episode is an episode called Death's Head Revisited.
Yes.
Mark, yes. What do you remember about that? It starred a great actor named Oscar, I believe it's pronounced Bregge, who seemed to have a career out of playing these aristocratic German officers in World War II movies or World War II. I personally was a huge fan of the old TV show Hogan's Heroes, and I remember him from an episode of Hogan's Heroes, if anything. But a very troubling episode about a former German army officer who revisits one of the, I believe it's Dachau, isn't it?
Yes, it was. He's a commandant of Dachau, and he's been a fugitive on the run since World War II, and he comes back in a fit of nostalgia to revisit Dachau, and the ghosts of his victims come out of the grave, basically, to try him for war crimes. And it's an astonishing episode, gorgeously written. Rod Serling wrote it. Many people don't know that Rod was Jewish, and so it's very funny because when I finished the Blu-ray set, and I did an audio commentary of this episode with Neil Gaiman, because I'm Jewish as well, and Neil Gaiman is Jewish too, and so it was fun, the triumvirate of we three writers, Rod and Neil and myself, all converging on that episode and talking about it. But it's really a phenomenal episode. And also, it speaks well to the fact that Twilight Zone was shot at MGM, and they have a back lot, and they could redress all the sets and the back lot, buildings and so forth. So in that case, they took a set from a Western ranch, something like that, and they revested it as the buildings of a concentration camp, and it really worked brilliantly well. And Joseph Schildkraut, who played the lead ghost, if you will, the concentration camp victim, he was in the movie The Diary of Anne Frank as Otto Frank, and he was in many, many films from the golden age of Hollywood, so he was quite an amazing actor himself. So he and Oscar Bregge were well matched in that episode. And again, Twilight Zone was a great venue for actors because you could get these amazing roles and just phenomenal.
Yeah, there was also an appearance by a veteran actor named Ben Wright. Ben Wright is famous as being one of the actors who were playing a German. He always played a German in The Sound of Music. He was the SS officer who came to get Captain Von Trapp in The Sound of Music. Again, one of the things that keeps recurring over this television show is the actors that you'll see and you'll say, oh, that was the guy that was in such and such a movie, because there were so many accomplished actors that appeared in this show. And one of the things, again, that I mentioned at the beginning of this episode of Breaking Kayfabe is the theme of this particular episode is a bad man coming to grips with what he's done and getting his comeuppance. And that's, again, a recurring theme.
Yes. And Twilight Zone was very much a show set in a moral universe, by and large. I mean, every now and then someone good would have something bad happen to them. But usually there was good people rising to their best selves or bad people getting a form of justice. So that's certainly a great example of that episode.
Sure. Barry, what about your number 9 pick?
So my number 9 pick is, I don't think Mark was a big fan of this one, and I'm going to quote you on this one, Mark. One of the weakest shows of the first three seasons, laying the blame on Rod Serling's script, written by Rod, directed by Elliot Silverstein, called The Passerby. And
I've kind of come around to liking that episode, oddly enough. So my opinions change over time too. It's a very moody episode. It's about a woman, a Southern wife at the end of the Civil War, who's sitting outside the ruins of her antebellum mansion, waiting for as all the wounded soldiers of the Civil War straggle by. And there's a Civil War soldier who spends some time talking with her and reminiscing and talking about life and the war and so forth. And it's a very, Joanne Linville stars in it, and she's very, very good in it. And it's very moody. And at the time, I thought it was kind of talking and kind of telegraphed its ending, what the gag is. But on repeated viewings, I've come to like it a lot more. James Gregory is in it. He's another very distinctive actor, instantly recognizable, even if you don't know his name.
Marty Miller, wasn't he?
And it's very Yeah, yes, that's right. Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And so but it's very solidly acted and it kind of sticks with you. So I've kind of come around on that one over time.
Yeah, and I don't want to spoil what it's about, but the two things stand out. I do think the acting's great. It's super moody. And when she approaches the soldier who is walking, that is somebody that she knew, Constable. I don't want to say it's creepy, but at the same time, it's an affecting scene. Like I see that, and what I take from that, I remember that a day later. The look on his face, and as she's talking to him. But there's a song that Mr. Gregory plays on his Gitbox several times, and that song also stays with me. If I had a criticism of the episode, and I don't know it's a criticism because I'm really somewhere in the middle, it is when Abraham Lincoln makes an appearance.
Yeah.
I'm somewhat torn on that.
Yeah, it's a little hokey. It's a little hokey, but still, it's, you know, it does stick with you, you know, and that's true of so many of the Twilight Zone episodes. I mean, even when I'm critical of the Twilight Zone episodes, even the bad ones are memorable. Even they're better than 90% of what you see on TV. Even the worst of the Twilight Zone is gonna leave an impression, and so it's a good attempt, you know, and so I've mellowed in my criticism, and that's why it's fun to do the new edition of the Twilight Zone Companion, because I get to come back after many years and say, okay, here's what I think now, or here's some added information. That's really, really fun to revisit it.
Yeah, and again, I'm still pulling most of my references from the first and second editions. I have a great story about the first edition. So years ago, I was managing a restaurant in New York City, and it was a restaurant on Madison Avenue, and we got every celebrity known to man. You know, anybody who was anybody would come in and they would eat there. And for the most part, it was just another day at the office for me. But Jean Marsh came in one day, and I about just lost my mind. And I said, oh, my God, you know, you're Alicia. And, you know, she was older at this point. And she invited me to sit down, and I sat down, and we discussed what it was like for her to film that episode. So I was so taken. Yeah, exactly. I was so taken with this that when I left work that day, I went to a Barnes & Noble, and I bought a copy of your book. And when she came in the next day, because she was coming in on a daily basis at this point, I actually gifted her a copy of your book.
Wow. How sweet. That's great. Yeah, she was a wonderful actress. And The Lonely, which is the episode you're talking about, is just a phenomenal piece of writing by Sterling. And Jack Warden and Jean Marsh, you know, Jack Warden plays a convict on an asteroid going out of his mind from solitary confinement. And John Dana, who plays a spaceship captain who brings him supplies, gives him a robot girl to keep him company, and he falls in love with her. And that the ending of that episode, again, I won't spoil it, but it's incredibly shocking. And particularly when you think of it, how, you know, when it was shot, to have that kind of an ending, it still makes you jump out of your chair. And she was just really great in that episode. So no, I'm really glad you got to meet her, and thanks for giving her a copy of my book. That's really nice to know that she had that.
Yeah, absolutely. So Jeff, your number nine episode?
My number nine pick is a episode that we already discussed briefly, and that's The Occurrence at Owl Creek Bridge. Just to give the listeners some background on it, basically what happens is it's set during the very end of the Civil War, I believe. And we have the Union Army is preparing to execute a Confederate spy on a bridge. As the episode progresses, the Confederate spy escapes from his near hanging and has decided that all he wants to do is get back home and get back home to his wife. And the episode is about him trying to escape the Union soldiers who are getting closer and closer. And all he wants to do is basically cross that finish line and get home to his wife. And there's a shocking twist ending to the show. I don't want to give any spoilers out. But again, as Mark briefly described, this was shot as a short film by I don't think it wasn't shot in France, was it, Mark?
Yes, it was.
It was. Okay.
And yet they had just a few lines of English you know, very, very fleetingly. And so it was, you wouldn't know watching it that it was French. There's really nothing to telegraph that other than the names of the filmmakers and the actors.
And I will say it's, you know, the very limited dialogue, it's not an episode that needs dialogue.
No,
you
not at
you
all.
Don't miss it. You don't miss it at all. So since we've already discussed
visual.
That.
It's very visual.
Yes. Barry, give us your number 8.
Yeah, and I should say, too, that I actually, Jeff, that episode I watched this morning. And it's, I love it. It's, Mark just brought up the word moody in describing, the passerby. That's about as moody an episode as I think you would actually find. So I actually really enjoyed it. So
and again, I will say this is an episode that I was shown in class at college. So, I mean, these are not just, entertaining. I mean, these are episodes that really make you think, that are, can serve an educational component. And that's certainly the case in this particular episode.
Yeah, so my number 9 is one that I like. I like the premise maybe more than the actual episode, but I really love it, and it's Little Girl Lost. And what I think is cool, I mean, I think it's just a great premise where, you know, somebody can fall into a portal to go to another dimension, but I really enjoy it. The two criticisms which you put in your book, and whether you have softened on these or not, I actually agree with these. The voice of the little girl is apparent to me that it's an adult playing a little girl. The other part is that the mother is beyond hysterical. While I get, you know, if your child disappears, certainly you're going to be hysterical. At the same time, she comes across like a raving lunatic throughout most of the episode. But the dad is pretty calm. He's like super calm about this.
Yes, and yet for all of its weaknesses, the central idea is so strong, and that alternate dimension that they go into to get the little girl is really fascinating to watch. And the fact that they shot a scene where a man put his hand through a wall, and that was done entirely by flooding light onto a wall with a depression in it, so you couldn't see the depression. So it's done in camera is really phenomenal, because it looks like he puts his hand through the wall, And of course, you know, this came from Richard Matheson hearing his little girl crying one night, and he went into a bedroom and she wasn't on the bed, and he felt under the bed, and she wasn't under the bed, and thought, what's going on here? And what had happened was she'd fallen under the bed and rolled all the way to the far wall under the bed, so he couldn't reach her until he really, you know, put a little muscle into it. And but that got his mind going, well, what if she had fallen into another dimension? Now, of course, many Twilight Zones have influenced movies. And there have been a lot of movies that are sort of Twilight Zone movies as well. And certainly Poltergeist is strongly influenced by that episode. And Spielberg hired Richard Matheson to write other films for him. And I think that might have been a little bit of a tip of the hat to the fact that Poltergeist was very, very, very derivative of Little Girl Lost.
Yeah, I love the ending dialogue, too, when Bill is telling the father and he goes, another few seconds and half of you would have been here and the other half. And that's how it closed.
Yeah.
I just thought that was so impactful.
Yeah, it's really fun. Yeah, and again, you know, and of course, another lesson we learned from that episode is that if your little girl's going to fall a hole between dimensions, it's good to have a physicist as your neighbor, you know? So.
Yeah. We all have that, don't we? Absolutely.
Yes, of course.
All right, Jeff, you're up, my friend.
Okay, my number 8 episode is an episode called Living Doll. And here again, we talk about great character actors. Telly Savalas plays the lead in this. Just a quick plot summary. He's a rather stern stepfather to a little girl. And for Christmas, the little girl is giving a doll. The doll's name is Talking Tina. And Tina seems to have a life of her own, at least to Telly Savalas. And the voice of Talking Tina, for those of you old cartoon fans, is played by June Foray, who was the voice of Rocky the Flying Squirrel in Bullwinkle cartoons.
Yeah.
So Mark, why don't you tell us what you remember about this episode?
Well, you know, June Foray, of course, is one of the great, great talented voice actresses of all time. She's also the voice of Chatty Cathy, which was a very popular doll of the time. And so that's why they hired her to do Talking Tina on Twilight Zone. It was very much a riff on the talking doll phenomena that was happening at that time. And it's a wonderful episode, really creepy, very effective. And the fascinating thing I found out when I was researching it was it was credited to Charles Beaumont, who was one of the leading writers on the Twilight Zone. But in reality, it was ghostwritten by a friend of his named Jerry Sowell, because on the final season of Twilight Zone, Beaumont was starting to exhibit the first symptoms of the presenile dementia that would kill him at age 38, and just a few years later. And so he could still get assignments, but he was having a lot of trouble writing them. So most of the scripts that were credited to Beaumont in the last season and a half of Twilight Zone were actually written by various of his friends. He could plot them with them, but they were actually executing them. And this is something that was totally unknown until I started interviewing people for the Twilight Zone book and finding out that story. And so it's quite, Beaumont was this amazing, charismatic man, brilliant writer, and he had a circle of very talented friends, and they kind of all stepped forward to kind of help him out, and it was very sad that he died so young, you know, but it was great that I was finally able to give credit where credit was due and let these writers know, you know, be known for their wonderful work. Jerry Sewell was a science fiction writer. He wrote a lot of novels. He also wrote for Outer Limits. But no one knew that he had written the Twilight Zone episode, one of the great ones. And so so I was very, very thrilled to be able to give him his appropriate credit.
Yeah, and this is one of those episodes, again, and this will be a recurring theme, is you have a not-so-nice person kind of getting their comeuppance in the form of talking Tina.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Yeah, and many episodes would have, talking dolls or machines coming alive, various inanimate objects that would basically come alive to mete out vengeance, you know, or justice.
Barry?
Yeah, so I want to give a shout-out to my 16-year-old son. This is his favorite episode, and I know this is one of my wife's favorite episodes. And this is a really scary episode. This was one that my daughter started watching. She's 13 years old, and midway through, she's like, you know, I'm going to go upstairs now. I don't think I'm going to watch this anymore. And that's at 13. But my son made a fantastic comment about Ellie Savalas. He goes, what's up with the guy with the Friar Tuck hairstyle? So it dawned on me that Telly Savalas has been gone for so long that my son did not know him from Kojak or obviously from anything else. But this is a great episode. Right. It did not make my top 10, and I got to say it easily could have. I did try to go with episodes that I felt were a little more, maybe not as in the mainstream, you know, not like Time Enough at Last with Burgess Meredith, only because I think if you think of the Twilight Zone, you think of Tina. Talkie Tina, you're thinking of Burgess Meredith and his books, and this is just a great episode, Jeff.
Absolutely. So, Barry, what's your number seven episode?
So, my number seven episode is the only hour-long episode on my list, and I got to say, you know, I know that there's mixed feelings with the hour-long episodes, and I guess overall, it wasn't a huge success because it was just the one season, but you know, I really like The Incredible World of Horace Ford. But the episode Miniature, to me, I could watch over and over and over, and it's such a nice episode. There's such a great acting, obviously, with Robert Duvall, but it's such a beautiful story.
Yes, it's a great episode. It was the last episode that Charles Beaumont wrote before his mind kind of gave out on him. And he put everything he had into it. It's gentle and interesting. It's a great love story. It's about a very shy man, who falls in love with a doll in a dollhouse in a museum. And it was just very unlike any other Twilight Zone episode. Very gentle. Robert Duvall was terrific. It's just after he starred in To Kill a Mockingbird as Boo Radley. And as you mentioned, there were 18 hour long episodes. That was during Twilight Zone's fourth season. They tried to expand it to increase the audience, and it didn't work. And so then they went back to half hours on the final season. But it's a great episode. Robert Duvall is terrific. Kurt Felton is in it as his mother. She was actually the first Alice Cramden on The Honeymooners, and then later was replaced by Jane Meadows. So that's a little piece of TV history. But it's one you can watch again and again, and I really like that episode too. It's one of my favorites as well.
Oh, fantastic. Jeff, have you ever seen that one? Jeff? It must be the bathroom break, Mark. These occasionally happen right now. So Jeff has about three or four super big gulps during each episode. So
Or sometimes you turn your mic off like I just did. This is a professional broadcast, folks.
Or that.
What I was going to say was here we've talked about in the last two episodes, you have Robert Duvall and Telly Savalas. I mean, could you get better than that in the 60s and 70s?
I know. It's incredible. It's such a great talent tool. And we're lucky that we still have Robert Duvall with us. You know, he's had such an amazing career and been so terrific over all these decades. And but Twilight Zone, you know, they had an eye for talent. And when they'd see someone, and they'd actually go to plays in Los Angeles as well, in New York. And so often, some of the actors they'd be getting would be fresh off the stage and that wouldn't have done TV before or movies. And these people would become big, big stars. So it was a great proving ground. And for those young actors, being in the Twilight Zone was really a feather in their cap and a real boost to their career as well.
You know, Mark, one of the things I'll say is, as Barry mentioned, part of this podcast that we do, we discuss old school professional wrestling, primarily from the 80s. And we find as we discuss things with pro wrestlers, we'll talk about a specific match. And sometimes the wrestler won't have a memory of a specific match that is just burned indelibly into our minds as part of our growing up process in the world of pro wrestling. Well, we find that in a lot of ways, it's very similar with actors, because I can recall an interview that Robert Duvall did with a local classic rock station. And all they kept talking about was, oh, my God, how great you were in The Godfather. And Robert Duvall's memory of that role wasn't as impactful as it was to the audience, because for him, it was just another, you know, it was another job. It was another paycheck. So, you know, what we think is something that they have to remember, they don't always necessarily do that.
No, it's true. And also, particularly in television, where they'd show up for like maybe a day or two or three or a week at most, and then they're on to the next one. You know, they're doing a Petticoat Junction or a Gunsmoke, you know, Manic. And so for them, it's just like, yes, exactly, another gig. But I will say that in terms of Twilight Zone, that was generally different, because the actors really loved the roles they were performing, and it really did leave a lasting impression. When I talked to Burgess Meredith about doing Time Enough at Last, he said, there isn't a week goes by that someone doesn't talk to me about this episode. And he really felt that it was a great piece of work. He was very proud to have been part of it.
So, okay, I'm going to take my number seven. Barry, my number seven is The Odyssey of Flight 33.
Oh,
wow. And I'll tell you, here again, we talk about character actors that don't give their due. The lead character in this particular episode is played by an actor named John Anderson. And as you see, John Anderson, he's just one of these guys that must have been in every other television show during the 60s and 70s. He was a great, terrific character actor. And tell us what you remember about this episode.
Well, John Anderson was this big, tall, good-looking guy, and flinty, very flinty. And so he would often play things like airline pilot. And this was a fascinating episode, because Rod Serling was a huge airplane buff. And in fact, he was in the paratroops during World War II. But his brother was an aviation writer. He wrote books about airplanes. He wrote a book called The President's Plane Is Missing at one point. And so Rod was driving his car, and he said he had this big Excalibur car. It was a very expensive car. And he said to his brother, you drive. And Bob Serling was very surprised, because Rod never let anyone touch his cars, drive his cars. And so he started driving. And Rod was getting an idea. He was thinking. And he said, what would happen if you had a passenger airliner and suddenly it picked up a tailwind and it found itself back in time? How would that work? And they started talking about it. Bob Serling knew an airline pilot and went and visited him and just spent the night, he said, you know, knocking back a bottle of scotch and going over all of the steps of what an airline crew would actually do in that situation. And then he called Rod with all of the steps of what would happen. And Rod wrote the script. And it's an amazing script. It's got a great dinosaur shot, a stop motion shot. Rod credited his brother Bob as a technical advisor on that episode. But it's a great episode. And again, many of the Twilight Zone episodes are great what-if stories, where you can't help but in another great episode on the airliner, of course, is Nightmare 20,000 Feet, where someone sees a gremlin on the wing of the aircraft. But again, I think Twilight Zone deals very well with fantasy notions. Like, what would happen if your daughter fell through a hole in dimensions? What would happen if you tried your airliner traveled back in time? All of those things. And again, our world still has many of those same. Those stories could happen now as easily as back when they were originally filmed. But we still deal with the same currency of raising children, flying on airliners, all of that stuff.
Absolutely. It's a terrific episode. And, you know, just for the people that haven't seen this particular episode, the airline crew is flying on a flight back to New York. They go, they have a little turbulence, and they look down, and as they're approaching, making a landing, they see something that was a symbol of the 1939 New York's World Fair, and they realize something's amiss, and that's where the episode begins, and where it takes us to eventually is what do they do? You know, what if, as you said, and that's part of what made this episode and so many Twilight episodes so good. So, so Barry, what's your number number six?
God, I love that episode too, Jeff. See, as I sit here, I'm going, you know what? I'm going to take out this episode and I'm going to put that one in. I'll continually change my mind. But exactly. I can't keep it straight. But so my number six is Charles Beaumont makes another appearance on my list. It's The Howling Man. And there's so much that I like about The Howling Man. I really like John Carradine in his role as Brother. But this other actor who plays Ellington, which is H.M. Wynant, and I wasn't really familiar. I just thought he was just great in this role. Just such a unique.
Yeah, I know.
Such a unique, you know, and Mark, I'll let you describe the episode, but this is one that, you know, I think when I watch it, it stays with me for a day or two.
I know. It's a great episode and one of the more lurid ones. It's basically it's a young man is taking a hike through Europe and he gets caught in a rainstorm and seeks shelter in a hermitage, and the hermits, you know, have a prisoner, a man in prison who's howling. And they claim that it's not a man at all, that they've locked up the devil. And our hero has to decide whether or not to let this prisoner go and help him escape. And it's based on a short story by Charles Beaumont, and then Beaumont did the script. And Douglas Hayes, one of the great Twilight Zone directors, directed the episode. And I was talking, when I interviewed Doug about the episode, he was talking about, you know, the main character is delirious, and how do you visualize that quality? And so they put the camera on what were called gimbals, they could have it shift its axis, shift the angle. And so whenever the character would turn around a bend or turn a corner, they would shift the tilt of the camera to get that sense of dizziness and disequilibrium. And it worked phenomenally well. And Robin Hughes played the man behind bars. And interestingly enough, Doug told me that they wanted a scene where I won't spoil the episode, but you know, when the transformation occurs and he wanted to be on the run, because he said, you always have transformations where, like the Wolfman with Lon Chaney, where it would be, you have a lockdown camera and it's an unmoving image and the guy's changing, or a werewolf. And he wanted a transformation while the guy's on the run. So they have these columns and they have the camera on a dolly track and they just had the many different stages of the makeup where he'd be running full out and the camera would be moving with him and they would just cut between the columns. And The Usual Suspects, when they shot that film, they were influenced by that sequence very strongly for the climax of that movie. And so, again, where Twilight Zone episodes had this enormous impact years and decades later.
Well, and that's just, and when I watch this episode too, it's, you know, the first time I saw it, and again, it's, we have to be so careful when we describe a Twilight Zone not to spoil the ending, even though, you know, most of these episodes or all of these episodes are over 50 years old. But at the same time, the first time that I saw this, you know, it was kind of like that TV show Homeland. If you're familiar with Homeland, which aired on Showtime, was Brody, you know, is he a traitor or is he not? And that was the premise. And this entire episode is basically built off of, is he the devil or is he not? But again, I think that the acting really, really elevates this episode as well.
It does. And one thing that's good is that there's an age makeup on H.M. Wynant, there's a little coda of the story where that takes place years later, and you see him as an old man. It's a great age makeup, because when you see H.M. Wynant now, 50 years later, he looks just like that. So they really nailed it, what he would look like as an old guy.
Yeah, and it was funny, as we were doing this, I actually pulled him up. He's still alive, and as of last year, he was still acting.
Yeah, he's an amazing guy, and really, really, really a great talent. So I'm glad that he got to have this terrific performance.
Absolutely. Jeff, what is yours, my friend?
My number six is a episode called It's a Good Life. And It's a Good Life stars Billy Mumy, who is probably best known to the listeners as the little boy in the show Lost in Space that ran for many years. It's a Good Life is about a boy named Anthony Fremont. who has the ability to read minds. And let's just say that you don't want to make Anthony mad, because Anthony does not react well to being angered. So tell us a little about that show, Mark.
It's a terrific, terrific episode. It was based on a short story by Jerome Bixby, who's one of the famous science fiction writers, and Rod adapted it, did a phenomenal job. It's basically about a little boy with incredible and malevolent psychic powers, and the town he's in is isolated. It's like we don't know if the rest of Earth was destroyed by his psychic powers, or leaving just the town, or if the town has been sent to another dimension. We have no idea. But he basically terrorizes this town that lit up of his mother and father and the neighbors. And there's a great ensemble of actors who have to play their fear of this little boy. And Forrest Leachman plays his mom, and John Larch plays his dad. They're terrific in it. And Bill Mooney was one of the great kid actors. And this is before Lost in Space. Bill was in three Twilight Zone episodes, In Praise of Pip, Long Distance Call, and this one. And this is, of course, the great Twilight Zone episode of Bill Mooney. Just wonderful in every way, and just haunting. And interestingly enough, I interviewed him about this episode. And years later, when if there was somebody he didn't like, in his mind he would wish them to the cornfield, which the character of Anthony does in the episode. And he and I worked together on Babylon 5, and more recently we've been working on Space Command, which is the show I've been shooting lately. And he's just a great guy to work with, and filled with wonderful stories about Twilight Zone and all the other shows he's been on.
Yeah, so to that end, too, so talking about Space Command, you have a heck of a cast here. As I was going through it, Robert Picardo, Doug Jones, I am a huge, huge Hellboy fan. So to see the name Doug Jones, Bill Mooney, who you've mentioned, but Jeff, and James Hong. I can't leave out James Hong, who played Lo Pan in one of my favorite movies of all time, Big Trouble in Little China.
Yes.
But we actually have a professional wrestling connection. John Morrison is also in Space Command.
Right.
Wow.
That's right. And he's terrific. He's wonderful to work with. And he plays a synthetic human. He plays a combat synthetic. And he's great. I love John. And so, yes. Well, you know, with Space Command, you know, I'm basically doing the science fiction show, the space-going show that I want to see. You know, something hopeful, something positive. So we shot the first 2 hours. We have a Kickstarter campaign now to raise money for post-production and visual effects. So it's Space Command Redemption. And so anyone who wants to throw a few shekels our way, they're welcome to. And but it's been, so I'm in England right now. I'm going to a conference to meet with TV executives and show them the first 30 minutes of the show and pitch it and see if I can get it sold as a series. And but it's really thrilling, and to work with actors of this caliber, amazing. And also I should say about John that when you see him, we have a fight scene with him, and just he's so astonishingly agile and fluid. He moves wonderfully. He's an amazing guy, and he's a wonderful actor and a wonderful guy too.
So Barry, why don't you give me your number five?
Yeah, absolutely, too. And I got to say, also, Mark, that is the first time the word shekels has ever been used on Breaking Kayfabe. So, I think we all owe it to send a few shekels your way now.
Exactly.
Yes. So my next episode, and I'll tell you the impact that this episode had on me. So it's a stop at Willoughby, and I love this episode, and I know that it's been called a companion piece to Walking Distance, and I can see the similarities, but at the same time, this is such a unique episode, and again, we talk about the acting. I was so taken with the acting, and especially Jason Wingreen. And Jason Wingreen was in three episodes, A Stop at Willoughby, The Bard, and The Midnight Sun, which I absolutely love, that there are Twilight Zone cards, like baseball cards. There are Twilight Zone cards, and there's a Jason Wingreen autograph card that I've actually purchased off of eBay because I'm such a fan.
Wow. That's great. That's great. Well, you know, again, you know, we've been talking about some of the name actors, but there's so many character actors who just make up the ensemble of Twilight Zone. There's an actor named Vaughn Taylor who's in Time Enough at Last in tons of other episodes. I sing The Body Electric. And again, you see these actors, they're almost like family members, you know, people that you come to really know and love. Certainly Jason is one of them, you know, and brings a lot to that episode. And of course, James Bailey, who stars in the episode, is spectacular. And you're right, there's a similarity to Walking Distance, but they're very different from each other, because Walking Distance is about a man going back into his own childhood. But Walking Distance is about a guy who goes into a fantasy turn-of-the-century town that doesn't exist, or if it exists, it's someplace other than his own experience, you know, so it's idyllic. It's someplace he longs to go. And it's a wonderful episode. It's a very sad episode, but it's definitely one of the greats. Absolutely.
Yeah. And there's such a great twist at the end. Again, you know, being that it's 53, 54 years later, I don't want to spoil it, but that last scene, when you understand, oh, wait a minute, okay, this all makes sense. And there seems to be a theme in a lot of these episodes, and as Jeff talked about, where the bad guy gets to come up in, the other aspect is like a shrewish wife. And in a lot of this, you know, selfish, cold, she's uncaring. He's basically a money machine to her. And then he starts to describe, and I think the acting again, he starts to describe this dream about Willoughby, and she just ridicules him, saying, you know, she calls him, you know, that she's married to a man whose big dream in life is to be Huckleberry Finn. And, you know, it's such a poignant, touching episode as it progresses. And I really can't say enough. This Jason Wingreen, too, it's, you know, once I say, wow, he's in two of my favorite Twilight Zone episodes. And, Jeff, you may have known him because I know that you liked All in the Family. He played the bartender in All in the Family for years. So he was one of these character actors that was really making the rounds.
Huh. That's great. But, there's so many wonderful performances. And in terms of shrewish wives, there are certain episodes that have that. Time Enough at Last is another one. But there are also some great female roles, like Eye of the Beholder, where there's a very strong female role. Or two, the episode with Elizabeth Montgomery as a Russian soldier in World War III, that's a very strong role, a very powerful role. So I think Twilight Zone certainly is representing some of the tropes of 1950s and early 1960s relationships. But they were also writing very strong roles for actresses as well.
So you just brought up Eye of the Beholder. So when I was a kid growing up, I had I would have been 6 or 7 years old, so I probably had one of the biggest crushes on Donna Douglas that any human being could ever have. And whether it was Ellie Mae Clampett or Eye of the Beholder, I was just smitten with her. So when you were watching Twilight Zone, was there a female that, as a child, you were like, God, she's just beautiful?
Yeah, well, Anne Francis is pretty spectacular in The After Hours. And also Ingrid Stevens in The Hitchhiker is just beautiful, just so beautiful. And I got to interview Anne Francis when I was researching the book, and she was wonderful to meet and just a great person, really, really warm and friendly and still incredibly beautiful even years later. And just really, really quite something. And, of course, she's in Forbidden Planet as well. And you mentioned Earl Holliman earlier, and he's in that movie, too, before Twilight Zone. That was the great big-budget science fiction movie of the 50s. But there was this great stable of actors. There were some amazing actors and actresses. And I think a lot of kids had crushes on some of those actresses, you bet.
Yeah. So, Jeff, you're up, my friend.
Okay, my next episode that I would like to talk about is an episode called Will the Real Martian Please Stand Up? Now, before we go to Mark, so here's the basic plot summary. We're at a lonely diner, sort of in the middle of nowhere, and there's a group of people in this diner just getting a quick bite. They've gotten off a bus, and two police officers arrive because there's been an accident. And Mark, take it from there and tell the folks kind of what happens with this episode.
Well, when they do the head count of the number of passengers, there's one more than they thought. And it turns out that apparently a flying saucer has crashed in a lake and frozen over. And they see footprints coming out of the lake, and they suspect that one of these people may actually be a Martian in disguise. It's a very fun episode. It's all in the diner. It's got Barney Phillips, who's a terrific actor. Really, he plays this wild-eyed, crazy guy. And John Hoyt, who plays a businessman. And John Hoyt was the first doctor on Star Trek. He was in the first Star Trek pilot, The Cage. Even when worlds collide, he's been in a ton of things. And he's great in this episode. He's got a great kicker. And it's funny because originally when Rod was thinking of the story, he was going to have the dog. There was going to be a dog in it that Soda Jerk owns, and the dog was going to turn out to be the Martian. But then Rod realized that was a really ridiculous idea. So he came up with something else that's one of the great kickers of the Twilight Zone. And it's funny because often Rod's comedies weren't really funny. They were kind of heavy-handed, didn't really work. This one actually does. It's one of his rare comedies that really, really does pay off. And I think it's huge fun. It's also one of my favorites, too.
Yeah, and as you know, we've talked about, there is a twist ending here, but it's a twist ending with tongue firmly in cheek, if you will.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And it was, and again, when I wrote the Twilight Zone Companion, I got to interview John Hoyt, and about that, and another episode he did called The Lateness of the Hour. And he was just such a charming, gracious guy, and he was a wonderful actor, and he was very, very, very precise, very skillful. And he had great fun doing that episode, because again, it's sort of like a whodunit, but a science fiction one of, okay, who's going to turn out to be the alien.
Yeah, it's also got, we've referred time and time again here to great character actors, the great Jack Elam, who must have approximately 1,500 credits to his name, and just has been in everything. And he's one of the guys, when you see him, you go, oh, that guy, of course I know him from, you know, this movie and that movie. So, Barry, we're up to your number four. Lay it on us.
Absolutely, too. And I should say, too, that Will the Real Martian Stand Up is our buddy Harold Strassler's favorite episode of Twilight Zone. Just want to give Harold a shout out. So my next episode. So I talked about these cards and Mark, have you ever seen these cards?
Yes, I have.
Yeah. So I'm really taken with these. And Jeff, I don't know if you and I have ever discussed it, but there was a company that a few years back released, and I guess there was more than one series of Twilight Zone cards, and some of them are actually autographed. And I've gone through eBay and I purchased them, and I keep them in my office as, you know, just something that I'm really intrigued by. But there is an episode, and this was the first card that I ever bought, and it's of the episode is Long Live Walter Jameson. And I got to tell you, I absolutely love this so much that when I was in college, and Jeff referenced this earlier, so I actually took a course on the Twilight Zone. And I forget exactly what it was called, but it was the social impact of the Twilight Zone in today's society or something like that. Your book... Yeah, exactly. So for me, it was an elective class, but I mean, how great that I could go to school every day and spend literally 55 minutes discussing and watching Twilight Zone episodes. So it was, you know, and I got an A in this class, I should say, maybe the only A I ever got in my life. So it was great, but your book was the Bible, and that's really how I discovered your book. But we had to write some sort of something Twilight Zone-ish at the end of the class, at the end of the year. And I wrote something which was just blatant plagiarism, and it was called The Perennial Man. And it was terrible, which would explain why I never wrote anything ever again in my life. But essentially, it was about a guy who could live forever. And it was very much, you know, it's got kind of that Highlander twist to it, which I also love the movie Highlander. But essentially, this is about a professor who's been alive for 2,000 years, and it's everything that actually develops. But I was so taken with this episode that the first card I ever bought was an autographed Kevin McCarthy card from Long Live Walter Jameson. Yeah. I will say, I think this movie, I think a lot of it is predicated on the relationship between Walter Jameson and the father of his fiance, Professor Kittredge, and the dialogue. Yeah. And this guy was an actor. His name was Edgar Steele. And I wasn't aware of him, and I went through and I read his bio, and you know, the guy was born in France in 1884. And lived to be almost 90 years old and passed away in the early 70s. But I was just, that dialogue between the two and the acting is just off the charts. And I just love this story. I love when he presents him a photo of the Civil War. And again, I don't want to spoil anything, but Mark, tell me, what do you think about this episode?
It's one of the great ones. It was written by Charles Beaumont. It's about, you know, immortality and the cost of immortality and how it might not be all you'd think it would be. It's phenomenal. It's a phenomenal episode. It was the original title of it was Forever and a Day, but Buck Houghton wanted something a little more specific than the producer, and so they retitled it Long Live Walter Jameson, which is kind of ironic, of course. And Estelle Winwood is in it. She's another great actress. She's in The Producers. Is one of the old ladies that Zero Mostel is romancing to raise money for his nefarious business operation. So, you know, for Prisoners of Love or Springtime for Hitler. So Estelle Winwood is in movies, you know, for a huge amount of the 20th century. And Andrew Stalin was, of course, another great actor. It's just a phenomenal piece of work. And it's fascinating also when you think about the writers writing for Twilight Zone, for the most part, were in their late 20s and early 30s. These were young guys, and yet they were writing about old age. They were writing about death. They were writing about issues that would be, you'd think, much older people would be writing about, but they were writing about it in a spectacular way with great insight and profound wisdom. So that's one of my favorite episodes as well. And William Tuttle did the age makeup on it, and he was the first makeup artist to ever win an Academy Award. He won that for Seven Faces of Dr. Lao, and he started on Wizard of Oz, so he was one of the great makeup artists of all time.
Well, Jeff, have you ever seen this episode?
That one I have not seen. I will have to check it out.
I absolutely highly recommend this episode. And there is a great scene, and Mark brings up a really good point about this episode, is that immortality is not everything that it's cracked up to be. And we think, wow, how great if you could live forever. And Walter Jameson basically says no. He goes, I just don't have the courage to kill myself. But this is so highly, highly recommended.
Yes.
All right, Jeff, you're up.
Okay, so my number four episode is an episode that we briefly mentioned earlier in the show. That is an episode called Nightmare at 20,000 Feet with William Shatner. This is an episode that was also part of the, I believe it was 1981, 1982 Twilight Zone movie compilation. John Lithgow took the role that William Shatner plays in this. And essentially, what it's about, it's about a guy who's on a flight with his wife, who is very nervous about flying, takes a look on the wing, and thinks he sees something. So, Mark, why don't you take it from there?
Well, it's again a spectacular episode. It was a fifth season episode, so it was done during Twilight Zone's last season. It was directed by Richard Donner, who had gone to do Lethal Weapon and Superman with Christopher Reeve. And so he's one of the great directors of all time. And he was a young guy just starting out at that point, and it was shot on an inside an airplane fuselage, and so it was very claustrophobic. It starred William Shatner before Star Trek, and it's basically the guy who had a nervous breakdown on an airplane previously, and now he's finally gotten out of the asylum. He's determined to prove that he's okay, and the first thing he sees looking out the window is a gremlin sabotaging the airplane that no one else can see, and so he has to first become confident that he's not crazy himself. And then he has to figure out what to do about it because no one, of course, believes him. And it was, as you said, it was made into an episode of the Twilight Zone movie with John Lithgow in that role. It was directed by George Miller, who directs Mad Max, of course. Although the monster was better in the movie, I didn't like it as well because in that one he was just, as you say, a guy who was afraid of flying, whereas in the original Twilight Zone episode he was a guy trying to prove his sanity after a nervous breakdown. It's just a wonderful episode. I it's one of my favorites, and Shatner's great. And he did two Twilight Zone episodes. He did Nick of Time, also by Richard Matheson, about the little fortune-telling machine that predicts your future, and he did this one. And Nick Cravat plays the gremlin, and that was Burt Lancaster's acrobatic part. So he's in a lot of Burt Lancaster movies, like The Crimson Pilot. You can see Nick Cravat, not as a gremlin.
I was hoping you were going to mention that because I loved him in The Crimson Pirate. That's a great pirate movie. One of my favorite action films of that particular time period when Burt Lancaster was first really breaking out into his own films. And I thought he did a great job in this episode. Barry, we're up to our top three. Barry, give me your number three.
So is it my number three or my number four?
You miscounted previously. I decided not to judge.
Gotcha. Okay. So my number three is The Silence. So it's written by Rod Serling, directed by Boris Segal, who I think is Katie Segal's father, if I'm correct. Wow. But essentially, it is Colonel Archie Taylor. He's this aristocrat, and he's part of a men's club, and there's a guy there that is kind of a braggart, and he bets him $500,000 that he can't be silent for 1 year. So, Mark, I'll let you take over. I got to say, again, I didn't know who Franchot Tone was prior to this, and then I Googled Franchot Tone, and wow, is that a story on a lot of different levels. But as an actor, this guy is the top of the heap.
Yes. Well, he's one of the great actors of the golden era of movies. He was very famous in the 1930s and 40s, a movie star lead. And so this is when I was talking earlier about where is everybody and the fact that could take place in external reality, objective reality. this is one of the other episodes that's like that. It's just, there's no real fantasy element in it at all, except it's just sort of an odd plot or a weird macabre plot. It was inspired by a short story by Anton Chekhov called The Bat, and Rod didn't remember that until later after he'd written it, but that was the inspiration. But this was another great episode. Jonathan Harris, who played Dr. Smith on Lost in Space, is in that episode. This is before Lost in Space. And he's great in the episode too, but it has a great kicker. And during the making of the episode, they shot the first day, the beginning and the ending of the episode. Then when they resumed to shoot for the next shooting day, Franchatone didn't show up. And what they found out was over the previous evening, he'd been drinking and he accosted a woman in a parking lot, and her boyfriend didn't take kindly to that and basically pushed his face into the gravel. And so his face was scraped raw on one side. And so they said, well, come on in, we'll make it work. And so they positioned him. They only shot him in profile or with half of his face behind a pillar. And it worked. It made him seem even more villainous. And the critics thought it was a great artistic touch, not knowing that it was actually trying to hide the fact that he was injured. And but you can see the episode. You can see that through the entire middle of the episode, you only see half of his face.
Yeah, it was funny. So when I read your book, I then watched the episode again, and it really does work. And it's one of those things. And again, I mentioned Franchatone, and he had this relationship with an actress named Barbara Payton. And a similar thing, her boyfriend, who was a bodybuilder, I guess, beat him up and put him in the hospital. So there was just a lot going on with him. But as an actor, especially in the beginning when he is calling out Tennyson, it's just super impactful.
Yes. Yeah.
Have you ever seen this one?
Yes, I have seen it. It's a great episode.
Gotcha. Where does this rank on your list of, let's say, 1 to 20?
This would probably be on my top 20 list. I didn't have it in my top 10. I'm actually kind of amazed, Barry, so far that we haven't had any rollovers where something on your list and something on mine is the same.
Yeah, well, I think that's going to speak to the depth of the show. And the truth is, you know, I could probably bring down my wife, who loves The Twilight Zone deeply like I do, and she's going to pull out probably, you know, another 10 episodes that wouldn't be on either of our lists either.
So, okay, my turn?
Yes, sir.
Okay, my number 3 episode, this is another episode that I believe I might have seen, that is such a good episode. It was shown in college. It's an episode about paranoia. It's an episode that when you live in South Florida and you have to deal with hurricanes and things like that on a yearly basis, and you watch the way that when a hurricane can hit and it's every man for himself and neighbor turns against neighbor, buddy, it always reminds me of The Monsters Are Due on Maple Street, because it's an episode that fits right in with today's society also. And Mark, your thoughts?
Well, it's one of the greatest episodes of The Twilight Zone. It's a phenomenal piece of work. It's a great script by Serling, a great ensemble cast. It takes place on a neighborhood street as aliens manipulate these people to turn against each other. It's every bit as relevant now as it ever was. It's just a phenomenal piece of work. And it was shot on the back lot of MGM on the Andy Hardy Street. So, the street that was, you know, where all the Andy Hardy movies were shot. So it's got a great cinema history behind it, but it's also wonderful on its own. Claude Akins is great in it. Jack Weston. Just these are actors who are sort of the backbone of all the TV of that era. You'd see them again and again in every show. And at the end, when you see the aliens, they're wearing uniforms from Forbidden Planet. Their spaceship is from Forbidden Planet. So again, it's using all those things to build the Metro's their movies, you know, which Rod had access to. And it's funny because when I was a producer on Sliders at Universal, because I knew that Rod had utilized all the sets and costumes and props from every MGM production, I said, do we have access to every Universal production and costume and set? And they said, we don't know. No one's ever asked that question. Then they checked and they said, yes. So we were using things from 12 movies and Jurassic Park and on, Time Cop, just because I asked the question, because I knew from writing the Twilight Zone book that Rod had done it at MGM.
Yeah, and again, as you said, this is an episode that is every bit as timely in 2017 as it was when it first came out.
Yeah, if not more so. I mean, absolutely. It's sad, you know, Rod says, it talks about in his little closing narration, talks about, you know, the sadness is that this can't be, you know, confined to the Twilight Zone, this kind of behavior. And it's true. And I think, it's a shame that it is so relevant, but it certainly is nowadays.
Yeah. Okay, Barry, what's your number two?
So my number two is another one that I absolutely love. And I got to say, it's something I constantly say when we talk about these episodes, is the acting. And I watch this acting, and I come away from it. And why doesn't acting today have the same kind of impact on me? I don't know. But Fritz Weaver in Third from the Sun just blows me away. And yeah. What I love about this is Richard Matheson, based on a short story from Richard Baer. And Rod Serling did the teleplay, but it is such a great story that the twist at the end is literally, they reveal the twist and 5 seconds later the episode is over, but it's such a cool story. But the camera work in this episode, there's a scene where they're playing cards on a glass table and they're shooting it from underneath the glass table. And to me, it's almost revolutionary. But Mark, please, I'll let you talk about this episode.
Sure. Yeah. Well, it was as you said, it was based on a short story by Richard Matheson. Serling adapted it into a teleplay. It was directed by Richard L. Baer. And Richard L. Baer did a number of great episodes, including the Perfect Testament, the one we talked about earlier, the World War II one. And his this was one of the earliest episodes of Twilight Zone was shot. It was the first season episode. And Richard L. Baer thought to himself, well, we want something about the visual style of this to tell us that something is unusual, something is odd. It's not what you expect it to be. And so they thought of all these weird angles and all these strange shots that they could do to be a little bit disconcerting, a little bit off-kilter. And that shot through the coffee table, the glass table, was one of those shots. And again, interviewing him for the Twilight Zone Companion, I was able to get, that whole rationale behind why they did that. It's a great episode. Joe Maross is also in it, and he's another really good actor. But Fitz Weaver is the backbone of that. And Edward Andrews is also in it, and he's very, very good as sort of the malevolent guy they work with. And this was, again, done just on the heels of the McCarthy era. People were and at the height of the Cold War, so paranoia and alienation and all of that was very much, everyone watching that show could identify with what those people were feeling. And it's a beautiful episode, wonderfully done. And Fitz Weaver, of course, is also in The Obsolete Man, which is another one of the great Twilight Zone episodes. So he certainly turned in some great work on Twilight Zone.
Yeah, and Edward Andrews too. So he was in another episode too, which was Drive.
Yeah, You Drive.
Yeah, You Drive. And as I was watching, we were flipping around the channels last night, my wife and I, it's about 11 o'clock at night, and 16 Candles is on. And I'm like, wait a minute, that's Carling. That's Carling from Third from the Sun. So he's actually in a few of the John Hughes teen movies as well. He just had a tremendous career. But, yeah, it's and actually Denise Alexander plays the daughter, and she was famous later on, I guess, for General Hospital. She was one of the main characters on General Hospital for years, and still may be.
Wow. Yeah, well, that's again, we're so lucky to be in a time now where TV and film allows us to watch these performances years, decades later. I mean, if we were back in the 19th century, we'd just be talking about stage performances we'd seen that no one else could see. Every episode we're talking about, someone can go and watch it immediately if they want to, and share this amazing work that these people did.
Absolutely. Well, Jeff, we are getting right about there. Your number two episode.
Before I give you my number two, I will say Edward Andrews, much like I mentioned Jack Elam before, another of those guys that must have had 1,500 roles with. He was in all those Disney live action movies of the late 60s and early 70s. A tremendous actor.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. My number two now here, Mark, is the time in the show where you're going to get to tell me how wrong I am for making this my number two pick. My number two episode is the episode that I really think, now that I recall, may have turned me on to the show, The Twilight Zone. My boss at work told me he was a big fan. Shout out to Dean Russi. And Dean told me, you got to see this episode that's called The Hunt. The Hunt is about country man who goes out with his dog, and they're going raccoon hunting. And again, one of the things I noticed about my two final episodes both of them have a twist ending. This episode, the ending is so good that I can look past some of the flaws in the earlier part of the episode because I enjoyed the ending so much.
Yes, and yeah, it has a great kicker, and anyone who's a dog lover is going to really love that kicker.
Rip.
And so I agree with you. I agree with you. I mean, my main quibble with it is simply the staging, because Arthur Honeycutt, at various points, people are supposed to not be seeing him, and it's just kind of staged awkwardly. But the ending is quite wonderful. And the fun part is something I didn't know when I wrote the book, and this is something that's in the new edition of The Twilight Zone Companion that's coming out in the next few months, is that Earl Hamner actually wrote that originally as a skit on the Kate Smith Hour in the 1950s, a live TV show, and the angel at the end in the live version was played by James Dean. So in the new Twilight Zone Companion, I'm going to have links to audio and video rarities, and you'll be able to actually watch that scene of James Dean in the earlier version of The Hunt playing that angel. So it'll be fun to compare that with what the actor played him in Twilight Zone.
I think you made an interesting point in the book where you talk about how the old man in the show, Hyder Simpson, and his wife Rachel, were sort of by Earl Hamner when he wrote the episode, the basic genesis of where he became, where he wrote about Grandma and Grandpa Walton and the Waltons.
Yes, they were. He was working out those scenes and finding those characters, and so they did become Grandma and Grandpa Walton when he created the Waltons a few years later. And because Earl Hamner was very different from the other writers on the show. The other writers tended to be sort of urban guys. They were living in L.A. They were kind of young and kind of hip. And Earl Hamner was an old backwoods guy. And he told me that generally the honest, forthright characters he wrote would be country folks, and the evil, screwed-up people would be city folks in his work. And, you know, and he said, which just shows you how provincial I was and am. And but he was a very dear-hearted man, and I think what he brought to Twilight Zone was very different from the other writers, and I think that's a good thing. He wrote an episode called Jess Bell that was an hour-long episode that I liked very much, and he was just a great, just a dear man, and we lost him recently, and that, you know, I still miss him. He was really one of a kind.
Absolutely. Well, Barry, we've come to that point in our show where I'll give you a little drum roll and ask you to reveal your number one episode.
So my number one episode is an episode that I can watch time and time again, and I will still get tears in my eyes as a scene towards the end, but it is Walking Distance. And it stars Gig Young, and if you really want to see, and again, I keep saying this, the acting, but the acting from Gig Young, even as he's walking through the soda shop, and he's just turning the stools, and he's just doing these little facial gestures. But this is such, it's a guy, Martin Sloan, he's having some car trouble. He leaves his car at a gas station. He realizes he's an hour and a mile and a half from where he grew up, which is called Homewood, and decides to walk and go see what Homewood is like. And without giving away too much, it's exactly as he remembers from when he was a child. And there is a scene in this episode where his father has a conversation with him. And if there's anything been written at this level, I'm just blown away by it. You know, when I read that dialogue, and Rod Serling obviously wrote it, but when I read the dialogue between the father talking to his adult son, literally, I get tears in my eyes. It's that good. So, Mark, what do you think about Walking Distance?
I think it's just a jewel. It's one of the greatest Twilight Zone episodes ever made. It's definitely one of my top episodes, too. It's some of Rod's best writing ever, certainly his most poetic writing. And the casting is, as you say, wonderful. And a little side note is there's a little boy in it who just has a few lines, and that's Ron Howard, before Andy Griffith, before the Andy Griffith Show or any of his fame. And but Gig Young is just perfect in that episode. Frank Overton plays his dad, and again, he's wonderfully cast, and they have a certain physical resemblance that really works. Irene Tedrow plays his mom. It's just so evocative and sad and melancholy, and Rod's closing narration is just, you know, I get tears in my eyes, too, every time I see it. And it's beautifully shot, beautifully directed. The music's by Bernard Herrmann. It's one of his great scores. He, of course, did Citizen Kane and Psycho and North by Northwest. He's one of the great composers. It's just beautiful in every single area. I mean, it stands the test of time. I think if anyone has a bit of nostalgia in them, a bit of longing for loved ones who are gone, they're gonna resonate to that episode. And Rod lost his dad. You know, when Rod was away in World War II, his father died suddenly of a heart attack, and Rod never got to say goodbye. And so I think this episode is very, very much Rod wanting very much to have a last conversation with his father. So it's hugely personal for Rod. And Rod grew up in Binghamton, and so Homewood is very much the Binghamton of Rod's youth. And so it's one of the most personal episodes of all of the episodes that Rod wrote.
Gotcha. And you just said something that I want to touch on, too. So you talked about the closing narration, and it is absolutely beautiful for this episode. So how important, and we obviously as viewers of The Twilight Zone, we realize the importance of the opening and closing narrations. But from your perspective, being so close to The Twilight Zone, how important was that to the show?
They were very important because Rod was, you know, prior to Twilight Zone, producers ran television and the writers were subordinate to them. Rod, as the host and creator and producer and major writer by far, it was his show, it was his voice. And nowadays, you have showrunners who are the writers, you know, David Chase and Matt Weiner and on, J.J. Abrams, Damon Lindelof, et cetera. Writers run television now. That wasn't the case back then. Rod was basically the first modern showrunner. And so the opening and closing narrations were Rod's voice, Rod's commentary. Even on the episodes he didn't write, he was still the host. And so you had a sense of it being his show. And I think that was very, very important. And Rod could comment on the world. And sometimes the narrations would not be, it'd be a little bit clunky. But when they were brilliant, they were brilliant. And Walking Distance is certainly one of the great ones, one of the brilliant. Without that narration, I think the episode would have far less power. And also it's unusual because it actually has narration in the body of the story as well. And that's very unusual for Twilight Zone. There were only very few episodes that did that. But and Rod wasn't originally supposed to be the host of Twilight, but it was sort of by default, you know. But thank God they chose him because he was absolutely the right guy to do that.
And that's actually a great story. So, and again, I learned this from your book, as I think I've learned everything about the Twilight Zone. So, an actor named Richard Egan was supposed to do the narration originally.
Well, originally they had a guy named Westbrook von Voorhees do the pilot, and he was the voice of the March of Time, and he was just too heavy-handed, too kind of bombastic. And then they tried to get Orson Welles, and he was too expensive, and that didn't work. And finally they kind of run out of options, and Rod said, well, how about me? And everyone kind of fell out of their chair laughing, but they kind of run out of options, and so they said, okay, well, let's give it a try. And, of course, once they did it, they knew that was the perfect choice.
Gotcha. Well, Jeff, I will do the drum roll for you right now. Drum roll and Breaking Kayfabe with Jeff Baldwin, your number one Twilight episode of all time.
Well, before I give the number one, my choice for number one, at least, I can just imagine the listeners out there going, oh, wait a minute, you guys forgot this episode. You forgot that episode. What's the matter with you? You're both idiots. So I'm going to list ones that just didn't quite make the top 10. I'm not going to go into any discussion on any of them, but for those of you out there wondering why I forgot this particular episode or that, I'm going to list these episodes that just missed. Those are episodes like Third from the Sun, I Shot an Arrow in the Air, which Barry mentioned, The After Hours, Five Characters in Search of an Exit, The Mask, To Serve Man, and the aforementioned Where Is Everybody, which was the very first episode, which was terrific and still is terrific. Those are ones that just missed my top 10. So, my choice has also been mentioned previously, and that is Time Enough at Last with Burgess Meredith in a tremendous, tremendous performance. I use that word tremendous way too many times. I've noticed that on my show. But this episode is just absolutely epic. It's about a very mild-mannered man whose name is Henry Bemis, and all he wants to do is to be left alone and read. And he finally gets his chance and finally gets enough time. And at the end, we have the ultimate super twist ending. Mark, tell us what you remember about this terrific episode.
Well, it's unforgettable. Anyone who sees this episode is never going to forget what happens. It's a great capper, a great twist ending. And Burgess Meredith is so lovable in that episode, so charming. And as you say, he just wants to leave. He's in a terrible marriage. He's a terrible boss. And he sneaks off to, he's a bank teller and sneaks off to leave in the bank vault and ends up as the last man on earth after a nuclear war. And that doesn't give away the capper. It just sets up the story. And Twilight Zone, of course, as I said, took place during the Cold War. So you had all these great after the bomb stories. And it was shot on the back lot of MGM. They had some steps. This big staircase that they used you can see it in The Time Machine, a movie they had recently made on the back lot, and so they redressed that as the remains of a library, and it's just a wonderful episode, and Burgess Meredith is wonderful in it. He did four episodes of Twilight Zone, but this is a great one that he did, and he wore a little mustache and they had these thick glasses. He told me that when they were in a long shot, the glasses would be clear glass so he could see, but in close-ups it would be thick prescription glasses, and you wouldn't be able to see anything at all. But I love that episode. It's definitely one of the greatest episodes of Twilight Zone ever.
Okay, Mark, as we get ready to wrap up here, I have three final questions for you. Tell me, just in your own estimation, tell me how you think The Twilight Zone compares to Serling's other show, Night Gallery, and another show that was run at approximately the same time, which is called The Outer Limits.
Yes. Well, Night Gallery has a few really good episodes. They're tearing down Tim Riley's bar is one of them. But Rod did not have final control over Night Gallery. He was very unhappy on that show. He was not he and Jack Laird, the show, the producer, did not see eye to eye. So Rod was very unhappy. Twilight Zone, Rod had complete control. And so that's his show. That's his baby. So I think Twilight Zone is really the more accurate example of what Rod could do at his full powers. And in terms of Outer Limits is, again, one of my favorite shows. Outer Limits and Twilight Zone and Star Trek are why I'm a writer today. And Outer Limits is, if you've never seen Outer Limits, it's a great black and white hour-long show. It only ran a season and a half, but it's well worth seeking out. Not the color one that was done years later, but the black and white one. Many of the same talents that worked on Twilight Zone worked on Outer Limits. You see a lot of the same actors. It's a darker show than Twilight Zone, but it has its own quality, its own flavor. Harlan Ellison wrote a couple of great episodes for Outer Limits. Many, many great episodes are on that show. Robert Duvall is terrific on that show as well. And so I highly recommend it. If you've never seen it, definitely seek it out.
Okay, now, two final questions. Number one, tell us in your own opinion, what is the worst episode that was ever done on The Twilight Zone?
That's a really interesting question. It's sort of a toss-up between two episodes. One is called Come Wander With Me. It stars Gary Crosby. It's about a guy who's in search of backwoods songs. It makes no sense at all. It's incoherent. And then there's one called Cavender Is Coming. It stars Carol Burnett and Jesse White. And it was actually shot, it was a spin-off pilot. It was shot with a laugh track. And so there's two versions out there that you can see. One with a laugh track that doesn't work. And then one where they strip the laugh track away. And so the actors will say a line and then wait because they know there's going to be a laugh track. And then they'll say the next line. So the timing doesn't make any sense at all. So it's just a failed pilot and it's kind of leaden. But those would be sort of the two bottom of the barrel ones. But still interesting for all of that. But those are the ones that I would sort of say are high for the bottom.
Okay. And finally, all the listeners out there want to know, you are the guy that wrote the Bible of the Twilight Zone, the Twilight Zone Companion. By the way, let me just say before we go too far that if you go to the tinyurl.com/superpodamazon, the book is available. It is tremendous. Barry Rose, I know, cannot give it a high enough review. The Twilight Zone Companion by our guest Mark Zickrey at Z-I-C-R-E-E. So I encourage all of you to check that out. So, Mark, the final question, tell us your pick for the greatest Twilight Zone episode of all time.
That's a really interesting question. By the way, the new edition of the Twilight Zone Companion is coming out in the next few weeks. So, again, one can probably pre-order that on Amazon as well. It's kind of a lot of new stuff, a lot of really cool stuff. But in terms of best episode, I was thinking about that. Walking Distance certainly would be one of my favorites. But one episode that isn't often mentioned, I think, is also right up there for me. in addition to ones like The Eye of the Beholder, which is a great episode, Kick the Can. I love Kick the Can. It's about a group of people in an old folks' home, and one of them gets the notion that if he plays Kick the Can, he'll become young again. And it's just so pointed, and Ernest Truex is heartbreaking as in the lead. And it was written by George Clayton Johnson. He was barely 30 when he wrote it. And it's just got such wisdom about age and about youth and about staying youthful in your life and the meaning of life. It's beautifully written. And it's just, again, like watching this, you can really see those two episodes as companion pieces in terms of just how moving they are, how truthful they are. It has a great ensemble of elderly actors. And I think that would be, I don't know if I'd say it's number one because there's so many great episodes, but it's definitely one of my absolute favorites.
Okay, well, Mark, on behalf of my good friend Barry Rose, I want to thank you for joining us. I know the listeners want to thank you. Again, I want to encourage all you folks to reach out and try to grab Mark's book, because if you are a Twilight Zone fan, I think we've given you at least 25 episodes to check out here, folks. You got your homework assignment. Yes. Barry, any last thoughts for Mark?
No, this has been a dream come true, Mark. I truly appreciate you spending time, too. Jeff, unless I'm wrong, this is the first overseas connection we've had. Mark is actually in London currently, wow. So we're super appreciative for you to spend the last 2 hours with us today.
I was actually hoping that that Mark would channel Edward R. Murrow and say, hello from London. So anyway.
From London.
Yes, exactly. So, folks, I will encourage you to follow me on Twitter at #BaldrinJeff. Breaking Kayfabe is a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. Special shout out to my man Brian Last on the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. And, folks, finally, not to end on a downer, I would like to dedicate this episode of my show to my good friend Chris Slankis, who I lost a couple days ago. I'm holding one up for you, an alcoholic beverage for you tonight, Chris. We miss you. And until next time, folks, thanks for listening.